Hi everyone, my name is Amandine Flax and welcome to a new episode of Entrepreneurs Playing Games podcast edition. About every 2 weeks, I host a live video stream where I deep dive into startup founders' journey after playing video games with my guests. Here is the audio version of our discussion, so if you are interested in the full video, be sure to check out my YouTube channel at youtube.com/AmandineFlax and also be sure to follow the channel there. And for any questions, suggestions, or just to say hi, you can find me on Twitter at AmandineFlax or at EntrepreneursPG. In this week's episode, I am joined by Anna and Christian, the co-founders of Symbiotica AI. I think before we get started and talk more about what you do, I think a good thing would be maybe to set up the foundation on the problem you're solving to understand why what you're doing is really cool.
Symbiotica AI is a fintech startup. We're about a year and a half old. We just finished our first accelerator program, ConceptionX. And what we do is we employ machine learning to optimize liquidity profile of financial institutions. So although it sounds like, you know, a bit of a mouthful, I'm going to take a step back and try to explain it in the plainest language that there is. Because I think a lot of people have a misconception that financial services and banking is an overly complicated and bureaucratic kind of industry, whereas it's not. It's a very exciting and fascinating industry with a lot of opportunities for employment of technology and innovation. So if we think of banking and financial services, the reason why we as a society have financial services is so that we can facilitate the exchange of money from people who have it to money to people who need it. So in that way, people who earn money, who earn salary every month, they put their money in the bank, in the savings account, and for that they receive a premium. And the bank who has the money from these people who have it, then can lend the money to people who need it. For example, the corporations who are raising funds to expand, or even the government who are raising money to, you know, build infrastructure, build hospitals, train GPs. So in that way, people who have money give money to people who need it. Then in that respect, the notion of liquidity comes in, and it generally refers to two things. One is, do I have enough money to trade? And is there someone to trade with? And how the two things fit together, like the, you know, people who have money, people who need money, and the liquidity, is that when banks give out the money to people who need it, they expect to receive this money later on. And sometimes people don't pay them back. And what that means is that somebody else who put money in the bank as well will
face difficulty.
Face difficulty when trying to receive their money back. So in a nutshell, if Christian borrows me some money, so I took money from Christian, and then you take money from Christian as well, so we both own Christian money. And if I go and spend my money, then I have nothing to pay Christian back, right? So what is Christian going to do? He's not going to have enough money. And that's how banks fail. So they don't have enough liquidity. So after 2008, the regulators have informed financial institutions to hold a certain buffer so that they can pay their clients no matter what happens.
It's known as collateral or collateralization.
So keep an eye on the big word, the big words to remember. Liquidity, collaterals, okay, yes.
Yeah, sure. So what Anna is actually referring to is funding liquidity, and it generally pertains to the liquidity required to, for institutions to be able to, well, banks mainly, to be able to conduct daily activity. There is another side to liquidity, which is known as market liquidity. And this is the ease at which someone can actually trade in the market, or essentially access liquidity to be able to trade with someone. So if I have a large portfolio of stocks, for instance, and I want to get rid of it, if there's not sufficient liquidity in the market, that causes problems. Also, traders, portfolio managers perceive it as what's known as implicit transaction costs. So this is costs that you can't explicitly measure. But they exist. So it's not a brokerage fee, for instance. It's just a fee that exists for conducting a trade.
Okay. So how can you plan ahead if you can't make sure that?
Is this a big issue? So yes, the issue we're trying to solve pertains to these two forms of liquidity.
Okay.
And the notion that, so essentially, financial institutions don't have a holistic view of their liquidity on an intraday basis. What this means is, well, the reason why is a lot of the banking infrastructure generally operates in isolation. Mm-hmm. So whenever a trader books a trade, for instance, by the time it actually reaches downstream and settles, that trade will not be the same trade anymore. It may have gone through what's known as netting or compression and a whole list of other activities. So the treasury desk within the institution generally has a problem mm-hmm. with this because they can't see these liquidity flows. And then the other, the market liquidity, this is more so on the trader side, as I mentioned before. Traders need to be able to execute their trades, but they're mm-hmm. funded by the treasury desk as well, so they need to go to the treasury, who gives them the capital required for them to conduct their activities on a daily basis. And the problem is the treasury doesn't have a view of this. They don't see the liquidity holistically flowing down. So where we come in, do you wanna?
Yes, I hope we didn't scare anyone by diving deep into financial services. I mean, I tried to kind of bring to try to compare financial industry to, you know, for example, supply chain, who faces the same kind of mm-hmm. problems. But where we come in as a machine learning company, we work with the data that financial institutions have, their internal transactions data about, you know, different payments that they've made and the payments that they have received. And we analyze this data using data science techniques so we can help them forecast their liquidity usage better. So in our current proof of concept, we used the high frequency data from electronic markets mm-hmm. and we analyzed it to predict what's known as a market impact. So how does the market price changes after I trade? So it's a very interesting and very important notion in trading, and it directly refers to liquidity. So I guess simple example to illustrate it would be liquidity of Christmas trees. So in the summer, nobody is really looking for a Christmas tree. Mm-hmm. So there is not much Christmas trees on the market. Nobody is really talking about Christmases. If you need one, you go to a specialized shop. Closer to Christmas, there is a lot of Christmas trees around. There is a huge bargain. You can go to different places around November, December time. The closer to Christmas you get, the less Christmas trees there are. So they become more expensive. And if you could have gotten one for, I don't know, 25, 30 bucks, I don't know, 15th of December, you can get one for, I don't know, 50 or like even 100. So the price increases. And that's what's known as the market impact. And financial institutions are trying to minimize it as much as they can so that they execute their trades and their financial obligations at the price that they predicted. So we come in and we help them estimate their market impact more accurately than the current tools that they have. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that they can schedule their trades better and decrease their costs.
Yeah, so generally the cost that they incur is the collateral that we mentioned earlier on. They're obligated to place essentially an additional pool of capital to be able to conduct a certain trade. Mm-hmm. So depending on the size of the trade, the risk profile of the bank, the counterparty that they're trading with, etc. The problem is the way that banks are measuring this is what's the worst case scenario given the past. Mm-hmm. That's really bad. And it's very rudimentary. I don't understand why they're doing this. Mm-hmm. But essentially, there are better ways to actually accurately measure your liquidity and therefore reduce the buffer and put it to better use elsewhere. And this is the issue that the Treasury desk faces today.
The solution that we're building can be applied not only in the financial service, not only in capital markets, but in payments or in supply chain, where everyone faces this notion of what happens if the other person doesn't pay me back, because I already have this, you know, other payments scheduled. So if somebody who has a mortgage loses their job, how are they going to repay? So that's the problem that applies not only in capital markets. And that's important to understand that the reason why we focus on financial institutions is because if they were to fail, it would affect everyone in the society. Whilst if, I don't know, a retailer fails, well, the people who work for it might fail, but the effect, the large scale of the effect would not be as significant.
So in the past, we've seen some banks failing, not many, and it doesn't happen that often, but it happened already, so it's something that can happen. But how can banks right now, what can they do, or what are they doing actually to make sure that they manage and control their liquidity needs? Are they doing something?
So first of all, banks don't necessarily, I wouldn't call it a fail. They still face difficulties. So there's flash crashes, for instance, that happen very often, which is essentially a significant drop down in the price of a security over a very short span. So this is because of liquidity as well, and algorithmic trading and all these other notions. But essentially, this illustrates that my financial markets are very unstable. The way that they've been dealing with this is,
as we've mentioned, after 2008, most of the sort of federal regulators in the US and the UK and the Europe, they obliged banks to hold a certain liquidity buffer. And what the purpose of this buffer is, if the counterparty of a bank fails on their payments, this buffer should serve as a
collateral.
Well, yes. As an emergency user, as an emergency cash. But again, the size of that buffer, it is determined at the moment primarily on the historical data. So what they use is a model that looks back at all the previous transactions that they've had and the previous demands for cash that they've experienced, and they find the biggest one and they say, look,
in the worst case scenario,
back in 1988 we had this one person who asked for $20 million in one go. So that's the collateral, that's the buffer that we need to have just in case that happens again.
Okay.
And it's very unreasonable, because when they compare their buffer and the actual daily intraday need that they experience for demand for payments, it's much lower. So there's always this gap that they cannot explain. What that means is they cannot predict their liquidity usage accurately. They do not have the model that can analyze data more efficiently and be able to help them reduce that buffer and predict it more accurately.
Why would they go through a third party, and why can't they just develop a solution internally to better manage and calculate the needs?
So really it's the data. That's one of the main problems as well. Generally building some form of machine learning algorithm requires a lot of specific data. Even the proof of concept that we built was quite restricted because of market participant identifiers that we couldn't get unless you receive proprietary data from these institutions. So that's the first challenge. The second challenge is, as I said before, a lot of the divisions operate in isolation. They don't talk to each other. Sometimes they have Chinese walls between them where they're not allowed to talk to each other. So that becomes a problem where you can't capture necessarily a view of your liquidity just because of the infrastructure and the restrictions on the infrastructure. And then I guess the third one really is, this is a research project. A lot of institutions, banks specifically, view research projects as quite a large investment.
Yes.
And it takes
a long time.
Yeah, so it's a long-term investment to them. And I don't want to mention any names, but just because we signed some NDA agreements, but some institutions that we're dealing with at the moment, when we go in there and we speak to them and we say, hey, what's your, are you doing optimal execution? Are you measuring liquidity, etc.? And you'll be surprised to find out that they're not, and we expect them to be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's just such a long-term project for them that they don't want to embark on it at the moment.
Okay.
But the need is pressing by regulation. It's mandated that they measure the liquidity and report it to regulators as well. So they're figuring out different ways of doing this, but they're struggling, and the regulators themselves have essentially handed out rules that they themselves don't know how to implement, or they themselves don't know how to advise on how to implement them as well. So that becomes a huge problem.
On the regulation aspect, just is there any consequences if they don't comply? Because if the regulations, even if they're not doing anything.
The problem with the regulations is, and in many countries, the regulators, they understand the problem, what the problem is, and then they say what the ideal case scenario is,
mm-hmm.
but they have no idea how to implement it.
When we talk about machine learning, we quite often talk about data, and we started touching this point earlier. So just first thing that comes to mind, do you need lots of computing power? Do you have any specific needs or any specific constraint due to the fact that you have to deal with a huge amount of data? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's a simple answer.
So we're dealing with high frequency data, at least for the proof of concept. There are other types of market data that's out there. But the high frequency data is basically on a tick by tick basis, which what high frequency means is the data is very granular, very, very granular. So one day's file could be approximately 8 gigs to 15 gigs.
Just
so
one day.
Yes.
Wow.
What we mean by tick is, you know, usually you have your data as a time series. So you have, you know, events that happen at regular intervals, like every minute or every second. With the financial data, you can have, I don't know, 100 of events that happen within the scope of a second.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about like a nanosecond timestamp kind of data. So you can easily see how for products that are traded very frequently, the data about this, like the data can easily become
large,
just
yeah.
enormously
so
large.
We analyzed the data over a year, so you can imagine if an 8 gig file is just over one day, what that means over a year or two.
But that's the kind of the trade-off. To build an accurate model, we need as much data as we can have,
mm-hmm.
so we need to look back at, you know, as far back as we can see. But what that means is that you require a lot of computing power to be able to do that efficiently, or it comes at a cost of a long processing times.
Mm-hmm.
So your during our proof of concept, which was my research work at the University of Glasgow, some of the algorithms that I have implemented, although they were optimized using some, I'll talk about the technicalities a bit later, but they were optimized to run efficiently, yet some of the algorithms would take me about a day to run.
Hmm.
So I would just turn it on in the morning and I'll go do my things and then come back in the evening like, goddamn, it's just some error. Or like the result is not as expected. And then you have to rerun the whole model again. I mean, going forward, we will be looking to utilize different, you know, infrastructures and resources that can help us do it efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a challenge, but not a bottleneck to for us.
But again, you need the data because the more data, the better the accuracy of the algorithm, and also you avoid what's known as overfitting of the model itself. The great thing is with electronic markets, there's a lot of available data, very clean data, depending on where you get it from. The data can be very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically had Google Cloud infrastructure, a couple of databases on there, and we built the infrastructure over a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. So you use their compute engine. We've tried a number of alternative providers like Amazon and Azure, just to name a few. But through our ups and downs, we decided to go out with Google.
Okay.
It might come up quite costly, but the nature of what we're doing, we need to be able to have the best infrastructure that is capable of
mm-hmm.
processing this. There is a notion, some of our potential clients and within the industry, there is a large concern with regards to the processing of data and whereabouts it is processed. So in that respect, we are talking directly with our clients and making sure that the way we're handling their data is according to their standard. And
mm-hmm.
for that reason, sometimes we have to come in on premises to be able to build our pilot and to prove our concept with them. So there is two sides of the data. You know, there is one that we have a lot of data and we can build a model. And then the second side is that within the financial industry, notion of data is very sensitive, and especially now because of the GDPR regulation,
yes.
we have to be very cautious of, you know, not only what we're doing with the data, but how we're doing it.
Yeah, how we're storing it as well, generally.
Exactly. And does this mean that when you're working on data from your clients and when you also get data from the market, does this mean that you have to put some kind of equation and just separate everything? Does it mean that you have to go to the client and train your own model or your solution with the data and that's it? Keep it like having a customized solution
mm-hmm.
for a specific client, or
yes.
does it feed back to your own solution, and the more data you get over time, the better it becomes.
So we're collating data at the moment from clients that we're working with. We don't want to produce a specific solution for a specific client.
Okay.
Really what we're trying to, I don't know if anyone's familiar with indices or an index. An index is a benchmark, essentially. What we want to do at the end of the day is come up with a liquidity index,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't exist across markets holistically.
Mm-hmm.
And
But I guess this is a more sort of a long-term vision. At the moment, we're still early in our journey of, you know, getting over that initial barrier of asking firms to share the data with us.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, in banking, it is very difficult. Luckily, we have a number of, you know, senior advisors, mentors and partners who help us, you know, speak to the right people and get us through to the clients. So in our sort of pilots, we're building with a number of, I can't mention the names, but I would say like big British banks.
Yeah.
So we come in on premises and we build our model trained on their data. So in that respect, the model is uniform and it can be applied to any data, but it's trained, tailored to their data.
Okay.
So the solution can be applied within any institution, but the data at the moment is specific to the ones that we develop in the pilot with.
There is
a big drive in banking, and not only in the retail banking, but you might have come across it. It's a notion of open banking.
Yes.
So you know how with current, you know, bank accounts, like a current account, the one that, or a saving account that you have, you can access it if you have an account with, say, Bank A, Barclays, you can go to TSB and access your Barclays account through TSB.
Mm-hmm.
So this similar drive is happening within the investment banking, where firms realize the benefit of consolidating data together and being able to see this coherent picture of their interactions. So some of this drive comes from a regulatory side.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an existing regulation, CSDR, which enforced firms to share the data to be able to understand how failure on certain transaction processing affects the rest of the market. And this project was successful. So following that success, we can then go forward and say, look, what we're trying to deliver is a solution that would benefit everyone in the market. It's not only for one firm to use and, you know, be better than others. What we're trying to do is to democratize the markets and to be able to deliver a fair price and a fair service to everyone.
And this is usually the technology that's adopted. I'm sure everyone, ledger technology, so blockchains is how they facilitate the sharing of information in
mm-hmm.
a secure manner. So that's basically, a lot of institutions kind of in the past have frowned upon it, but more so in recent times, it's being adopted quite well.
Okay.
So, yes.
So they're very open about that. They don't mind adopting
with a little push.
Okay.
With a little push. I guess they come a lot of very senior people in finance come from a, you know, a long background of, you know, running the firm.
Yes.
And, you know, relying on the what they know. And when this innovative technology drive comes in, they're very cautious, but not to say that they're reluctant. They're willing to try, they're willing to see, they're very positive about bringing the improvements to the industry, but they're also very cautious and sensitive about it.
And we also are right now talking a lot about banks, but you mentioned earlier that the solution could also be applied to different industries or use cases. What kind of, or in the future, what kind of industry could be also in your target?
So we can shift away from banking slowly.
Talk about Bloxprint.
Oh yeah. So currently we're involved in UCL's Bloxprint. The reason why is so...
A little bit of a promotion.
What is it? Yeah, what's Bloxprint?
So
we are actually looking for teammates. So
okay.
If anyone's interested, drop us a note. Go on.
Yeah, so Bloxprint is essentially a hackathon project that's being run out of UCL. What they are trying to do is utilize distributed technology, so ledger technology, in order to solve various problems within finance. So again, it comes back to finance, but it's not necessarily banking.
And I mentioned earlier, we can also apply our solution to supply chain.
I met Anna at RBS a few years ago. She was working in the prime broker service and front office technology, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And I left to go do some other things in other financial institutions. And one promise basically we are technicians.
We're engineers.
We're engineers, big geeks.
So we both come from a very technical background, and we enjoy very much.
So, but one thing that we were frustrated with within banking is there you have a lot of legacy technology, so they deal with a lot of legacy technology, and the drive to push innovative technology specifically within the front office is very difficult. So Anna decided to depart from the industry and embark on her own journey,
yeah.
Essentially, but the promise we made was if you ever decide to do something not to do with banking or something completely different, let me know. So she went up to Glasgow. She was self-funding her master's degree, mm-hmm. in quantitative finance, and she was immediately, essentially, as soon as she got there, called me up and said, hey, I have a solution. No one solved it. It's known as optimal execution. Do you want to come up and help me build the infrastructure around it?
Yeah.
At the time, I was at Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, cool. quit my...
I'm going to go to Glasgow.
quit my job, went up there, and within a couple of months, we set up all the infrastructure, gathered the data, and this was me essentially managing all the infrastructure and all the things that were needed to actually put this in place, and her implementing the machine learning algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
And where we got to is we started basically building a... I'm not sure if, well, there's probably an audience of data scientists out there. So we started with essentially what's known as a decision tree, and then moved mm-hmm. it over to a random forest. And what this means is we were trying to measure what's known as market impact. And inherently, when you do this, you also measure what's known as liquidity as a byproduct of measuring the market impact of trades. So today, what we've built is a machine learning algorithm, which we're using... deep neural nets, as probably a lot of other people are, which gives you a more accurate measure of liquidity within the market.
Measure as in like forecast.
Mm-hmm.
So it can forecast the expected market impact more accurately. So during my degree, as Christian mentioned, when I went to Glasgow, so I decided to kind of leave my career in front office, and I got a little bit of tired, you know, progressing with my sort of a ladder within the firm, you know, becoming a manager and then managing a team. And although I enjoyed growing as a leader, I felt like my technical background and my skills are not flourishing. So I decided to go back into academia and to kind of put myself in that environment where I can, you know, decide what I want to do and focus on something that's important to me. So as following what Christian just said, very quickly I went to speak to different professors and said, look, I want to implement something practical, and I want to do something that can make a difference. I have this like technical skills. I can code. I can lead a team. I have, you know, industry experience, and I'm very passionate and very driven. Everyone was surprised about it, but nonetheless, we came. I met my supervisor, Professor Ankush Agarwal, in the University of Glasgow, and he, with him, we had a discussion about the beautiful mathematical problem of optimal execution, and it's how agents interact in this stochastic environment,
mm-hmm.
and come up with an optimal decisions and eventually end up in a Nash equilibrium. And what that means is we all achieved such an optimal position of what we're doing that by somebody else trying to do something else wouldn't make it better. It's a bit of a mouthful, but long story short, it fascinated me because there was a challenge of not only, you know, technical implementation and mathematical foundation, but also how does this practically apply to the industry? What pain can we solve right now? So when Christian and I started working together on this, you know, the infrastructure and the implementation and, you know, data gathering, pre-processing, we understood the technical benefit of it and the beauty of a problem that we're solving,
mm-hmm.
but we asked ourselves, how does it benefit the industry? Like, why would somebody, you know, be interested in that? So we enrolled on the accelerator program Conception X,
yes.
which is targeted specifically at the early stage startups, primarily started from UCL, but they're also open to candidates from other universities such as ourselves. We are from Glasgow, and they help early stage companies progress through their entrepreneurial journey and bring them forward to their sort of next round.
So I just would like to get back to some of the different aspects you mentioned. And first, it's the research part. So as a startup, how do you integrate research into the day-to-day activity?
The research process is we basically adopt a data science process,
mm-hmm.
which is an extension of the scientific method. And what you do is essentially gather data and you go through an entire pipeline of trying to disprove some form of a hypothesis. So we call this a null hypothesis.
I guess one of the misconceptions that we often find from people who, from various people, is that they think that machine learning and deep tech is all about, you know, get the data, put it into algorithm, and it spits out, you know, this wonderful results.
Magic.
The first part of it, the data, is actually critical. The hardest and the longest part of it, because you not only need to consolidate the data, which is often hard to find and hard to gather, data pre-processing and understanding your data, getting it ready for the algorithm is where we tend to spend most of the time. And that's why every time we, you know, we mention that, you know, the next step for us is to get the data. Without the data, we can't really do much. Mm. So in our research, we always make sure that we make, maybe not that, you know, complicated or sophisticated algorithms or decisions, but we want to make sure that whatever we do is robust and there is, you know, a transparent picture of how we got from A to B. Because it's important within our industry. So a lot of clients are asking us, how are we going to explain to our investors what you're doing?
Yeah.
This notion that machine learning is a black box is another kind of a, how would I say, common thing that we come across that people think about. Mm. One of the most important things that we've learned in our journey this far is fail fast.
Yes.
If you want to try out something, just do it. If it doesn't work, at least you know. Sitting there and thinking, oh, I have a brilliant idea that's going to solve everyone's problems, it's never going to happen. If you want to build something, if you want to build a company, if you want to try to build a company, you have to go out there and you have to speak to people. Those who cherish the idea and think that it's fantastic are going to be hugely disappointed when they bring it out to people.
Yeah, you don't want to sit in a dark room and code everything and then come out and no one wants it.
About
your idea. So,
Couldn't agree more. You also mentioned that you're talking to investors.
Mm-hmm.
What are they first reaction and what's your plan ahead once you're done raising money? I think right now you're raising your first external investment and first institutional funding, right?
So yeah, the investors we met through the ConceptionX program a while back, essentially we're at the stage in the journey where we need to scale significantly, and that's not only scaling the technology itself with our clients but also scaling the team.
Yes,
it's so hard trying to stay on top of everything when there's two of you, and we both want to, you know, build things, we want to both, you know, research and do things, but there is, you know, meetings, there is, you know, emails, there is, you know, this and that and thus, and you hardly notice how the week goes by.
She deferred her PhD for this, so...
Yeah, so my plan initially when I was started my master's is I got so engaged into research and to, you know, learning and engaging mm-hmm. with, you know, new technologies, new ideas, that I was planning to go do a PhD in financial computing at the University College London. And I had, you know, a unique opportunity to work with some of the leading industry experts at the top university in the world on a program that is specifically tailored for those who are interested in fintech. But during the time of my master's degree and when Christian and I started working on Symbiotica, the things picked up and we literally just saw the scale of how this could be applied within the industry quickly and how there is a need for it. So I've made a decision to postpone my PhD just now
mm-hmm.
because I think it's more important for me to be kind of a full-time on this and drive the company while we have this, you know, the wave, the opportunity.
So yeah, over the next couple of months, essentially, the raising the capital is for the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Market data is very expensive. Although we're working with banks for the proprietary data, we also need some external market data sources.
Mm-hmm.
That cost a lot. And then the team. So hiring the right specialists who basically share our vision of more stable and efficient markets.
Is there anything that is missing for you right now in the ecosystem that you wish you had more support with?
But that's another thing that we've learned. I guess it's an interesting story to mention, but when we just started, like when I asked Christian to come to Glasgow and, you know, start building a company, we also asked two more people from Glasgow University on my course to be part of it
mm-hmm.
and to build the idea with us and to go for this journey. to only kind of quickly realize a couple months after that not everyone has ability to commit and not everyone can take this as seriously as you. So finding the right people is one of the most challenging things that we've sort of faced. And luckily we kind of quickly realized that, you know, it's not for everyone. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to just bring anyone.
So right now you're raising money, but any other big milestones coming?
Yes. So essentially we have set ourselves a goal of 12 months.
Okay.
Maybe extend it to 18 months. Don't know yet. Essentially what we want to deliver is the scalable minimum viable product in the hands of several clients who are using it within their institutions, from their treasury desks to their traders. Mm-hmm. And
so we've mentioned earlier that we have a pilot agreed on with three or maybe four British banks. Mm-hmm. So this is something that we're going to be focusing on over the next 12 to 18 months to build this pilot and to develop into the minimal viable product.
So that's really what we're doing, which involves the whole hiring process.
Sure.
Which involves the setting up of the office spaces, etc. Yeah. etc.
We are considering enrolling into another accelerator program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can mention Techstars.
Yeah, because specifically because of the nature of what we're trying to do, we're a fintech startup, and Techstars, and specifically Barclays Techstars, is mm-hmm. a unique opportunity for people, for companies like ourselves, to be able to gain access to the right people and the right resources. There are other programs that are very attractive, but maybe suitable for, you know, different kind of businesses.
Okay.
So that would be another step on our journey.
I think Techstars is in January, so okay. we'll start there.
So you have some time to plan your application then.
the application process is already far yeah. gone. It's just plan okay. what you are looking to deliver, because
what
it
you
really
want to achieve
you,
from it. Define yeah, the goals and the objectives yeah. and the deadlines.
Yes.
Okay.
Because at the moment we're still kind of confirming, you know, the funding, the yeah. pilots and the Techstars, and having this clear roadmap for the next year is mm-hmm. what we're trying to focus on now.
Yeah.
Okay, exciting. So I think we are reaching the end of the interview. Maybe we can take one last question from Laser, who asked, where do you guys see yourself in 5 years? That's a big question, but sure.
Yeah, sure.
Let's try to answer that.
So the whole idea was for efficiency and stability of financial markets, right? And we were trying to democratize specifically what's known as market making. So market makers are the ones that actually facilitate the mm-hmm. liquidity in the market. And what we envision this becoming in 5 years' time, maybe, I don't want to speak too early, is essentially utilizing reinforcement learning technology, machine learning technology, and AI in order to become a lead market maker external from banks
mm-hmm.
and provide liquidity profiles using the technology that we are, facilitate the ability to actually make markets on behalf of our clients. So I know it's a lengthy goal and it's not,
but that's where we started. We started with optimal execution. It has always been at the heart of our research at our company, and we don't want to lose that. Now, although we found like a pivot idea, which is a liquidity management, which is more immediate to what the clients need right now, mm-hmm. and that's an existing pain point, we don't want to lose that optimal execution side of things that
sure.
drove us to where we are now.
So we still want to incorporate that later on.
And that's the part of research. Remember you asked us like if there's going to be someone doing the research. Yes, there is. As we grow and scale our company, we will be working with the data, so we will be collecting some of the data ourselves as well mm-hmm. that we can use later on to, you know, train the reinforcement learning agent.
So reinforcement learning is, I don't know why people have placed it in with machine learning, but it's not machine learning. It's a lot of what AI is about, really. And I'm sure there's a lot of computer scientists that are sitting on the other side. And really the way I like to think about it is, it's an abstraction of object orientation, and we think at the level of agents and how intelligent systems interact with each other. And the whole process is, the whole notion is learn by doing, mm-hmm. right? So take actions in order to optimize some utility function, essentially. and this can yield high benefits within the markets themselves. A couple of firms are already exploring this specifically. You know, JP Morgan have been doing this. And this is, how do you train an agent to make these optimal decisions on how to execute your orders, how to slice them up, how to serialize them to various exchanges, and how to get the best price accordingly. So hopefully in the future we get to do this type of research.
Huge thanks to Anna and Christian for joining me on the stream today, and thanks to all of you for listening to Entrepreneurs Playing Games podcast edition. For my part, you can find me on Twitter at @AmandineFlax, and be sure to check out my YouTube channel at youtube.com/AmandineFlax for the full video version of our discussion and much more. Also, if you want to join the live stream and ask your own question to our next guest, Entrepreneurs Playing Games is taking place every 2 weeks on Saturday mornings. So keep an eye on our social media, and I hope to see you there very soon.